2 meter band.
Today is Wednesday, October the 27th. This is VOA's International Edition. I'm Jackson Vunganyi in Washington. U.S. President Joe Biden has announced plans to provide up to $102 million to expand the U.S. strategic partnership with the Association of Southeast Asian Nations. And Facebook's top executive is defending the company against allegations that it puts profits above user safety.
The so-called Facebook papers released by a whistleblower shows the company did know about trafficking of domestic workers, crackdowns on Arabic content, promotion of hate speech, and anti-vaccine misinformation.
Turkey is threatening to launch a new military operation against Syrian Kurdish forces after a deadly attack in Syrian territory where Turkish forces are present. And UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres is calling on the international community to defend against the epidemic of coup d'etats.
That effective deterrence today is not in place. We have seen it in Myanmar, and we have also seen it in several African locations.
Nigeria, Africa's largest economy, has launched the continent's first digital currency, the e-Naira. We'll have this story and more coming up right here on International Edition. Stay tuned. And for our top story, Facebook's top executive is defending the company against allegations that it puts profits above user safety. AP's Jackie Quinn reports.
CEO Mark Zuckerberg opened an earnings conference call with a defensive posture, saying Facebook works hard to make the right decisions about curtailing content versus free speech. He says the divisive content isn't Facebook's creation. It comes from a polarized society, and he welcomes regulations to help provide clarity. Zuckerberg calls the criticisms unfair, alluding to leaked documents which acknowledge women being sold as maids on the platform and Arabic language posts being suppressed. Meanwhile, he noted the company's profits increased in the third quarter and says profits will take a hit in the fourth as Facebook devotes billions of dollars to new virtual and augmented reality products. I'm Jackie Quinn.
The influence of YouTube, TikTok, and Snapchat on kids was the subject of a hearing on Capitol Hill on Tuesday. AP's Shelley Adler reports.
Democratic Senator Richard Blumenthal heads the Senate subcommittee, which recently heard from a Facebook data scientist. This time around, they're focusing on how young people are affected, and his office created a YouTube account for 18 to find out.
We watched a few videos about extreme dieting and eating disorders. They were easy to find. YouTube's recommendation algorithm began to promote extreme dieting and eating disorder videos each time we open the app.
Jennifer Stout is the vice president of global public policy for the group that owns Snapchat.
I have tremendous respect for this institution and the work that you are doing to ensure that young people are having safe and healthy online experiences.
I'm Shelley Adler.
U.S. President Joe Biden has announced plans to provide up to $102 million to expand the U.S. strategic partnership with the Association of Southeast Asian Nations. The announcement came Tuesday during a virtual summit with the 10-nation bloc, as VOA's White House Bureau Chief Patsy Widakuswara reports.
Brunei's head of state, Sultan Hassan al-Bolkiah, hosted Tuesday's virtual summit of the Association of Southeast Asian Nations, or ASEAN.
This year, we have made significant progress in strengthening our cooperation with external partners.
One of those external partners is the U.S. During the summit, President Joe Biden announced plans to provide up to $102 million to expand its strategic partnership with the bloc, including $40 million to help address the current COVID-19 pandemic and strengthen ASEAN's ability to prevent, detect, and respond to future pandemics.
Our bottom line is that ASEAN is essential. I want to say that it is essential to the regional architecture of the Indo-Pacific. And the United States is committed to ASEAN's centrality. You know, it's a linchpin. It's a linchpin for maintaining the resilience, the prosperity, and security of our shared region.
President Donald Trump participated at the ASEAN summit in 2017, but skipped the following years. The economically dynamic regional bloc of 10 Southeast Asian nations is seen as key to countering a rising China. The trade group U.S.-ASEAN Business Council welcomes America's re-engagement. Mark Mealy is Senior Vice President for Policy at the U.S.-ASEAN Business Council.
We're talking about a region that by 2030 is going to be one of the largest regional economies in the world. We're talking about a part of the world where over 21 different states in the United States have annual exports of over $1 billion U.S. dollars in goods to the 10 countries in Southeast Asia.
While the U.S. is seen as a security guarantor against Chinese military ambitions, Washington is lagging behind Beijing in economic ties. ASEAN is China's largest trading partner. Both are part of the Regional Comprehensive Economic Partnership, or RCEP. Signed in 2020, it's the world's biggest free trade agreement, but excludes the U.S. The U.S. is also left out of the Comprehensive and Progressive Agreement for Trans-Pacific Partnership, CPTPP, a free trade agreement formerly known as the Trans-Pacific Partnership. The 2016 TPP was promoted by President Barack Obama.
Officially terminated TPP,
but abandoned by President Donald Trump in 2017. Prashant Parameswaran is a fellow with the Wilson Center's Asia program.
On several issues, whether it's trade or climate, the United States plays an important role in setting the table and then sometimes leaves the table. And these countries like Japan and ASEAN are able to continue on the legacy thereafter. But I do think the United States ends up losing.
While U.S.-China rivalry has intensified, ASEAN members underscore the need to cooperate with both nations, but at the same time ensure freedom of navigation, including managing tensions in the Taiwan Strait. Indonesian Coordinating Minister for Maritime Affairs and Investment, Luhut Panjaitan.
What's the benefit for the conflict happening in that area? What's the benefit? Who get the benefit? Nobody. Nobody. COVID is enough created the problem.
Myanmar did not attend this year's ASEAN summit since the group banned its junta leaders for ignoring a peace roadmap agreed to 6 months ago following the country's military coup. Patsy Wirakuswara, VOA News at the White House.
UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres condemned the military takeover in Sudan, calling for the release of Prime Minister Abdalla Hamdok and all other officials.
I once again strongly condemned the forceful military takeover of power in Sudan. And I urge, of course, all stakeholders to exercise maximum restraint, but the Prime Minister and other officials that were unlawfully detained must be released immediately. And it's true that Sudan has achieved important milestones. They cannot be reversed. And so it is essential that all transitional arrangements and institutions as defined in the constitutional document be reinstated. The civilian-military partnership is critical. It needs to be re-established at the level with which it was established. And I think the Sudanese people has shown very clearly their intense desire for reform and democracy.
Guterres was speaking on Tuesday from the UN headquarters in New York, where he said that the international community must come together to defend against the epidemic of coup d'etats.
We are seeing a multiplication of coup d'etats. The fact that we have strong geopolitical divides, the fact that the Security Council has lots of difficulties in taking strong measures, impact of the problems of COVID and the difficulties that many countries face from the economic and social point of view, these three factors are creating an environment in which some military leaders feel that they have total impunity, they can do whatever they want, because nothing will happen to them. And my appeal, obviously, is for especially the big powers to come together for the unity of the Security Council in order to make sure that there is effective deterrence in relation to this epidemic of coup d'etats.
That was UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres. And despite a military takeover in Sudan on Monday, Nurdin Sati, Sudan's ambassador to the United States, remains in his post and vows to continue working with U.S. officials. In an interview with VOA's Nabil Biagio, Sati said that he rejects the military moves and is coordinating with Sudanese diplomats around the world to mount pressure on Sudan's military leaders to release Prime Minister Abdalla Hamdok and restore a civilian-led government.
I reject the military coup that was perpetrated on October 25th, I shall be working with my colleagues in the diplomatic service and with the diaspora around in the United States and around the world to see to it this coup is not accepted and that the coup's intentions and results be reversed as soon as possible.
Since the coup on Monday, have you received any instructions from Sudan whether you should continue serving as Sudan ambassador to the U.S. or whether you have been relieved from your duties?
No, nothing. I have not received anything so far.
The government that appointed you has been toppled, the government of Prime Minister Abdalla Hamdok, and he's detained, he's imprisoned. This puts you in a weird and awkward position, does it not? What is your next move?
Well, my next move is to continue serving as ambassador of the Sudanese people and ambassador of Sudan, the country, as long as it takes. I shall remain in position to defend the principle of the government that has been toppled illegally by the military. And I consider myself as being the ambassador of a country, not ambassador of a regime. And the principles of the cabinet and the prime minister who has appointed me continue to be upheld and supported by the Sudanese people and the international community.
If General Burhan decides to fire you and appoint a new diplomatic mission, let's say in the U.S., will you defy the order and refuse to abandon your post?
I will, cross that bridge when I come to it. I cannot foretell what will be my reaction. It depends on the conditions that will prevail from now until that decision. And things are going to be much more complicated than that. In order for him to appoint a new diplomatic mission will be also an issue. And we know what happened in the past when the Bashir coup took place in Sudan. What happened? I'm the first ambassador, after 27 years. So I don't see, it's not going to be easy for this regime, this body to appoint a new ambassador to the United States.
You're saying it's an issue of legitimacy?
Of course. Yeah.
So you're saying they have power, but they don't have legitimacy. Is that correct?
Yeah, absolutely.
You mentioned in your statement released this past hour that you have joined other diplomats here in New York, but also in other capitals, Paris, Brussels, to resist what is happening in Sudan. What are you doing exactly? Have you talked to U.S. officials?
I am talking regularly to U.S. officials. Today I spoke to staffers from Senate and officials from the State Department. And yesterday I spoke to Assistant Secretary for African Affairs at the State Department. I continue to engage, the U.S. administration and Congress and to explain the position. And I have to say that there is an overwhelming support to my position and that of my colleagues who have taken the same position. And we shall continue. I engage, of course, with the diaspora, and I had a meeting with the representatives of the diaspora in the United States yesterday, which was a very good meeting, and we agreed to work together. And I believe that my colleagues also in other embassies, like the one in Brussels, in Paris, in Geneva, in Beijing, in South Africa, and in New York, are doing the same thing.
So when you meet with U.S. officials, you say you've been meeting with them. What are you exactly telling them that they should do to help the situation in Sudan, to reverse the coup and restore the government of Prime Minister Abdullah Hamdok. What are you asking them to do?
I am asking them to put pressure on the coup perpetrators in order to reverse the action that they have taken and to take the country back to where it was 48 hours ago and to accept to engage wholeheartedly with the civilian component in order to take the country out of this crisis. A military coup has never resolved problems. It is only adding to our problems and complicating issues, things for us. So that's the message that I'm passing here at the United States, to put pressure on the coup plotters in order to change, what they have done, to accept the will of the people, and to go back to free the Prime Minister Hamdok and the ministers who are illegally detained, and allow them to continue doing their job. In coordination with the military.
That was Nureldeen Sati, Sudan's ambassador to the United States. He was speaking to VOA's Nabil Biagio. You're listening to International Edition on The Voice of America. I'm Jackson Fanganyi. Turkey is threatening to launch a new military operation against Syrian Kurdish forces after a deadly attack in Syrian territory where Turkish forces are present. Dorian Jones reports from Istanbul.
With Ankara blaming the Syrian Kurdish group, the YPG, for this month's fatal car bombing in the Turkish-controlled Syrian Afrin region, President Recep Tayyip Erdogan indicated he has reached his limit. Erdogan said, "We have no patience left in some areas that are a source of terror attacks aimed at our country from Syria." Turkey accuses the YPG of having links to Kurdish separatists fighting in Turkish territory, a charge the group denies. Erdogan says Turkish forces and Syrian rebels backed by Turkey will seek to oust the YPG from the strategic town of Tel Rafat. Ankara believes that is the launch pad of the Kurdish group's attacks against Turkish forces in Syria. But Russian forces control Tel Rafat, along with the airspace. Özgür Ünlü Hüsükçükle is an analyst at the George Marshall Fund office in Ankara.
Russian cooperation Russian facilitation would be of utmost importance because Russia has air dominance in the area, and because it is actually the area that Tel Rafat is not too close to the Turkish border, any Turkish operation would be very difficult. Without Russian approval.
Ankara has long sought Tel Rafat, as it would link three areas of Syria under Turkish military control. But with the Syrian town, a vital transportation hub, and close to Syria's second largest city, Aleppo, some observers say Moscow will be wary of giving Ankara such a valuable prize. They include Gulab Dalai, associate fellow at Chatham House in London.
Russia will drive a hard bargain, and at the end of this hard bargain, this process will involve many give and takes. And if Russia thinks that it will get something significant in return, then it is a possibility. In the end, let's not forget, the two out of three Turkish operations into Syria were facilitated by Russia.
The YPG is backed by the US in its war against the Islamic State group, and any Turkish operation against the Kurdish group could further strain already complicated relations between Turkey and the United States. Turkey is to hold presidential elections by 2023, and that could factor into Erdogan's calculations. Aydın Selcan is a columnist for the Divar news portal.
Either the diplomatic and the real cost of any move, any new military operation in Syria will be considered as exorbitant. Or maybe such a story will be needed in this election year as a propaganda tool.
As analysts see it, a strike is a real possibility. Turkish forces have already carried out three Syrian military operations, observers point out, and say Erdogan rarely makes empty threats. Dorian Jones, VOA News, Istanbul.
Voice of America!
At least 20 asylum seekers have tested positive for COVID-19 while being detained at a hotel in Australia. From Sydney, Phil Massa reports.
About 46 male asylum seekers have been detained at the Park Hotel in Melbourne. Almost half have tested positive for COVID-19. Some are reportedly immunocompromised, including one detainee who has burns to more than half of his body after he set himself on fire at an offshore processing facility. The detainees were flown in from Australian offshore migrant camps in Papua New Guinea and Nauru during the past 2 years, mostly for medical treatment. The Australian Border Force, which operates the hotel detention facility, says those who are unwell have been closely monitored and given proper medical care. A media release states that multiple nursing staff are on site and a general practitioner has attended the site and is available via telehealth at all times. It adds that all detainees in Australian immigration detention facilities have been offered COVID-19 vaccinations. However, refugee advocates tell a different story. They insist the hotel has become an incubator for the virus and that nursing staff work only during the day. Ian Rintoul, a spokesperson for the Refugee Action Coalition, a community campaign organisation, describes conditions inside the hotel as a national scandal.
There is one who's been hospitalised quite seriously. People have serious symptoms, chest pain. Some people are quite unwell, others are, mild symptoms. But the idea that they're being monitored regularly is just nonsense. They've got no access to fresh air, no access to exercise. It is not a proper facility to be quarantining or isolating people.
Almost every asylum seeker in the Melbourne hotel has been detained by Australia for more than 8 years. A 2013 policy barred any migrant trying to reach Australia by sea from resettlement. Papua New Guinea was one of two Pacific countries paid by Canberra, along with the small Pacific Republic of Nauru, to detain asylum seekers and refugees. The agreement with Papua New Guinea, or PNG, is scheduled to finish at the end of the year. Migrants there will either be transferred to Nauru or be allowed to resettle in PNG. Australia grants resettlement visas to about 13,700 refugees each year under various humanitarian schemes. Australia has detected 160,000 coronavirus cases since the pandemic began. More than 1,600 people have died. 74% of the eligible population is fully vaccinated, and long lockdowns in Sydney, Canberra and Melbourne were recently lifted. Phil Mercer for VOA News, Sydney, Australia.
And in other news, the United States says that it strongly opposed Israel's plans for Jewish settlement expansion in the occupied West Bank as damaging for peace prospects between Israelis and Palestinians. This is the Biden administration's harshest public criticism of Israeli settlement policy to date. Israel on Sunday published tenders for about 1,300 new settlement homes in the occupied West Bank, and authorities are also expected to discuss proposals for another 3,000 homes. For more on this story and other breaking news, visit our website at voanews.com. And while there, check out our other programs: Upfront Show, Africa 54 TV Show, Straight Talk Africa, Our Voices, and many others. And remember to connect with us on social media. We are on Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram. Just search for VOA Africa. You're listening to International Edition on The Voice of America. I'm Jackson Bunganyi. A UN report says extreme weather and the impact of climate change killed thousands of people and resulted in enormous economic losses in all parts of Asia last year. The Sashline reports for VOA from Geneva.
A multi-agency report coordinated by the World Meteorological Organization warns the lives and livelihoods of millions of people across Asia are being threatened by floods, tropical cyclones, drought, and other weather and climate hazards. The report says extreme weather and climate events are affecting agriculture, food and water security, worsening health risks, and causing the mass displacement of vulnerable migrants and refugees. It says the cost in damaged infrastructure and lost ecosystems runs into hundreds of billions of dollars a year. Among the many weather anomalies hitting Asia is temperature rise. WMO spokeswoman Claire Nullis notes Asia had its warmest year on record in 2020.
The most extreme temperature that we saw last year was in a Siberian town, Verkhoyansk. We saw an amazingly incredible temperature of 38 degrees Celsius. We're still investigating whether this is a new record for north of the Arctic Circle.
The report finds sea surface temperatures and ocean warming in and around Asia are increasing more than the global average. It says temperatures in parts of the Arctic Ocean have been warming at three times the global average during the 1982-2020 period. A major problem affecting the region is that of melting glaciers, which will have a huge impact on food and water security. High mountain Asia is home to approximately 100,000 kilometers of glaciers centered on the Tibetan Plateau and the Himalayas. Nullis says the region has the largest volumes of ice outside of the polar regions. She notes it is the source of 10 important rivers in Asia upon which millions of people depend.
Glacier retreat is accelerating. It's projected that glacier mass will decrease by 20 to 40% by 2050. This will affect about 750 million people in the region. Major ramifications, obviously, for global sea level rise, regional water cycles, and in the short term, more hazards such as landslides, avalanches, etc.
The report finds floods and storms in 2020 affected about 50 million people in Asia, killed more than 5,000, and has resulted in more than $400 billion in accumulated losses just in China, India, and Japan. Meteorologists say the costs of extreme events in Asia are rising and warn the trends are expected to continue in the future. They urge nations to adapt to the climate-changing events and to invest in renewable energy and other protective technologies. They say the high-stakes investments will result in multiple socioeconomic benefits. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
Nigeria, Africa's largest economy, has launched the continent's first digital currency, the e-Naira. The launch also ranks Nigeria among very few nations in the world to adopt the electronic money system, which leaders hope will help boost the country's GDP and fight inflation. For VOA, Timothy Obiezu reports from Abuja.
The official launch of the Central Bank of Nigeria digital currency, CBDC, took place at the State House in Abuja on Monday, with top government officials attending. Nigerian President Muhammadu Buhari unveiled the e-Naira and said it could potentially boost Nigeria's gross domestic product by up to $29 billion over the next decade. Blockchain technology expert Jadel Chidi welcomes the launch.
Digital currency helps to faster payments, you know, and is also supposedly less expensive than the regular payment systems we have already. And you make your transactions, you know, person to person. You don't need an intermediary.
The e-Naira app went live and became available for citizens to download immediately after the launch. A digital currency is a means of payment that exists purely in electronic form. Other types include the cryptocurrency, which authorities banned in February, saying its instability exposed citizens to huge financial risks. The government expects the e-Naira to improve store of value for Nigeria's weakening currency, as well as drive financial inclusion for millions of citizens. But digital money experts like Janet Katio say internet penetration and tech savviness could present initial problems.
For every technology that is new, people have to learn how to use it. It is no different with the digital currency, the e-Naira, or even the cryptocurrency. People need to learn how to use these things.
Authorities say with the eNaira, they can better monitor transactions, curb black market trading for the paper currency, protect against devaluation, and lower inflation. Timothy Obiezu for VOA News, Abuja, Nigeria.
This has been International Edition on the Voice of America. On behalf of the entire production team, thank you so much for listening. Remember to visit our website for in-depth coverage of world events and news 24 hours a day at voanews.com. Until next time, I'm Jackson Vunganyi in Washington, wishing you a great day.